Welcome back for the third hour. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. For this last hour of the program, what's on your mind? We haven't done one of these in a long time. Just open mic, open potpourri. Hopefully not stream of consciousness. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. At 5:30, in about 25 minutes, we're going to talk with Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical Association about Proposition 71 in California. You've probably heard about this because Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger decided to come out for it and is pushing hard for it as well. And they've got the cadre of celebrities who are all making their appearances in favor of Proposition 71. It's a bill in California that would fund embryonic stem cell research. It is a clone and kill bill. Clone the human embryo, destroy the human embryo, do your research, and you do it under law. What it would do is actually fund, with California state tax money, clone and kill procedures. Now, we'll be talking about that in 25 minutes. I raised the question before the break, the prenatal screening. There's this triple test. I don't know what it is because with neither of our children did we have this done. But many of you may be familiar with this. You go into the OBGYN, the wife is pregnant, they say, we've got this triple test that we do. It's a standard screening procedure. I don't know if it involves what, amniocentesis. I remember when I was a little kid, my mom telling me that she had this test done when she was pregnant with us. Because we were twins, and in those days, they considered that higher risk. And so they did this to check us out, see if we were healthy. Now, they have these tests for prenatal screening. And we had someone write us and say, look, there's little or no advantage to the baby to pre-screen. Because perhaps, in many cases, it proves fatal to the baby. She also says this specific topic, pre-screening, prenatal screening, is very often avoided by the church and life groups because of the emotional element for the patient and because of the energy and the cost of care. Yet she says many untold babies are never born because of these tests. Now, granted, many unborn babies are born and cared for nicely by their parents because of these tests. They're given a chance to kind of prepare for what may come after the birth. But many are aborted, it's true. What do you think about prenatal screening? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Should Christians have this screening done? You know, the doctor is going to say, even if the doctor's pro-life, he's going to say, okay, I have to at least inform you about the options. Some of the options are let the child come to full term. We'll see how this goes. Here are the risks that I need to tell you are associated with your child's condition. And although I would not recommend it, there is also the possibility of terminating this pregnancy. That's how they would probably put it, right? Now, I'm not going to do it for you myself, but if you need, I'll give you the name of somebody. Do you want to put yourself in that position? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I want to hear from you on this, especially our female listeners. Our first caller is not a female, but he's calling from his car. Greg, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hi. It's funny you talk about that. My employer, man, he's my age, 43, a while back came in, found out his wife was pregnant after 13 years had a daughter. Years ago, he was kind of stunned. Anyway, in the process of doing it, because she's as old as she is, they recommended amniocentesis because they said to check for Down syndrome and stuff. And we were talking about it, and he said, you know, they were making arrangements to do it. And I said, for what purpose? And he said, well, so they would know. And I said, you know, there's a risk linked to amniocentesis, right? It's a 1% risk or so. And if it doesn't work out right, your baby could die. Is it worth the risk of killing your baby just to know something about it? I said, if your daughter right now, if you could find out a little bit more about her, but you would risk killing her, would you do it? And he said, well, no. I said, well, did they tell you it's a little risky? Well, no. And I said, well, what purpose is gained? Are you going to have an abortion if it's Down syndrome? He said, no. I said, so how is there any gain? There's no gain. You're just satisfying some sort of curiosity, but if nothing's going to change, why take any risk whatsoever? It's hard enough having a baby at 43 with no problems, much less adding in a problem to it. So they chose not to do it. It turned out it was a Down syndrome baby, another stunner, but that baby's beautiful, and they love it, and he's an adorable little kid, The doctor recommended this like it was no different than, you know, eating a lollipop or something. There's almost no risk in it, 1%. And to me, adding 1% is 1% more than I need to add.
Greg, thank you very much. What about the rest of you? Prenatal screening. It is not often discussed, but it is very common. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Diane's up next, calling from St. Louis. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Todd. I had 5 kids, and I just didn't personally want any amniocentesis. I had several pregnancies after 35, and they automatically want to give it to you, and I just didn't want to have it. But now I have a neighbor who has had the regular ultrasounds, and they found a problem, so they had her go and get this super-duper other test, and they did find some problem with the baby, and she was glad that she found out so she knew what to expect. I personally wouldn't want to know, but she was glad, and I think, you know, it depends on the person.
So in other words, your neighbor, at least your neighbor, felt like this gave her an opportunity to, well, I'm thinking in terms of like medical care and preparing for a child who's going to have special needs. That's the kind of thing you think, well, maybe we could sock away some extra money, or maybe we could make some provision in how we set up the room or what we're going to do with our physician, and we can plan ahead. Is that the kind of thing that she appreciated?
Yeah, that's what she felt.
All right. Diane, thank you. Beverly is calling from her car. Beverly, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Yes.
Hi. Good to hear from you. I've had 4 babies, and I refused the test with all 4, and of course, from my Christianity stand, but also, Todd, I did it as a mother. To me, a baby was wanted, and that's what God provided. Even if I wasn't a Christian, I'm hoping women would feel that way anyway.
So
would not do it.
So you were kind of with Greg where he says, why do you need to know?
Right.
Why do you need to know in advance?
And that's probably a very personal decision for a lot of people. Even with Christians, they're going to differ on this. But I was already loved that baby, and it didn't matter. Whatever came, I would learn to live and deal with it. And so I didn't want that test, and my doctor was wonderful. He just said by law, I think in Missouri they have to offer it, but he in no way pushed it, and I had 4 kind of really difficult pregnancies, and that was the last thing I was going to do. So every baby is just what God gives you.
Beverly, do you think that the screening test could be a temptation to abort the baby?
Yes, and, you know, really, why else is that? Why was it developed? It was probably one of the underlying reasons, and I tell you what, Todd, it's getting more and more tempting to young girls and women to abort a baby for almost any reason, that this is just one more thing that adds to that temptation.
Beverly, thank you for the call. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What do the rest of you think? Lael is calling from St. Louis. Lael, welcome.
Hi. I agree with her, too. It's a personal thing, but then again, there's a really big temptation to, if there's something wrong, to abort. But there is one positive issue that a neural tube defect, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
But they can do an in vitro surgery.
I was thinking exactly the same thing.
To repair that and then really help that child out long before it's born, and it advances their situation.
Well, you're talking here about what most people think, spina bifida, something like
right.
that. Where the child's spinal cord and spine are not developing correctly, and it's amazing, unbelievably
yeah.
amazing, that they can do in utero surgery
mm-hmm.
and do not, if not completely correct, then really mitigate the effects of this kind of physical deformity. And that's exactly what I was thinking. Now, without the screening,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't know. And here's the kicker on that one, Lael. Without the screening, the child might be at greater risk
right.
in surviving a normal birth.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So there you go. I mean,
yeah.
very, very good point. Thank
and
you very much.
That's an alpha-feta test. I think that's a single alpha-feta. You don't do the quad or the triple. I believe that's just the alpha-feta.
So now you're just talking gibberish to me, Lael. I don't understand any of the terminology. But then I've never been a pregnant woman before. You learn it real fast, I imagine, when you are. It's open lines, issues, et cetera. My question for you, we're talking about prenatal screening. It was raised by a regular listener who wrote me some time back and asked this question about, well, why would you want to know? And she says many untold babies are never born because of these tests, because they do present for people the temptation to abort or, as one of our callers pointed out, maybe just the excuse to abort. Well, you know, I was kind of on the fence on this abortion thing. I didn't know if I wanted the child. Then we went in for our first prenatal thing, and the doctor did this test, and they found out the baby has Down syndrome, and that pretty much cinched it for me. Terry is calling from her car. Terry, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I had a friend that they did some kind of blood test on her, and there was a possibility of her child being Down syndrome. And, you know, and the child came out just fine. So, I mean, you always can't rely on the medical test to give you the full picture until the baby is actually there.
You're correct. They are not 100% accurate.
Right. You know, I mean, it was a scary thought, but it's like, how many babies were aborted because they thought that something was wrong and the baby could have been, you know, a healthy baby?
It's a great question. Terry, thank you for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm also imagining a woman who says, look, I am adamantly pro-life. I am not going to be tempted to abort, but I do want to know in advance so I can prepare myself and prepare whatever else needs to be prepared in case the child does have some sort of problem, genetic or otherwise. So I'm doing this as a responsible parent. Would I want to know in advance if my child, say a toddler, was developing some sort of a disease? Would I want to know as soon as possible so I could help my child in every way possible? Well, sure you would. You wouldn't say, don't tell me about it. Now, see, we so often talk about the child in the womb being just the same as the child after it is born, and that is absolutely true. So how would you respond to an argument from a woman who says, I'm pro-life, I will not abort my baby regardless, but I want to know in advance? Because I would want to know in advance after my child was born anyway. My child was 10 years old. I'd want to know in advance, if I could, if my child was developing cancer or something else. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Claire from High Ridge, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I wanted to address the fact that the amniocentesis was derived around the time that I was in nursing school. And at that time, the doctors that were doing it in the particular hospital I was affiliated with were using it to check for anomalies, for blood problems, for heart problems, and whatever, in assisting the embryo fetus baby growing so that they could be brought to full term. And from that point in time, then technology took over and offered other things. And I think that it's important for all women in the age group of conceiving a child and planning to conceive a child that they need to avail themselves of all the information about what type of tests would possibly be done, as well as explore what they believe so that they can handle this, because the devil is out there tempting them in things that perhaps that they would feel is against their own beliefs.
Claire, thanks for the call. So well-informed. Well-informed. Sure. We want to be well-informed about everything that's going to bear upon the well-being of our children. Should Christians use prenatal screening? I want to hear from you, especially our female listeners. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. There's the woman who says, look, I'm not going to succumb to temptation. There's the woman who says, why do I need to know? Why put myself in the position? I may think I'm not going to succumb to temptation, but if temptation is as other temptations are, I wouldn't invite temptation, you know. Someone says, honey, I want you to marry me, but first, here's the prenuptial agreement. And most people look at that and say, this guy's looking for an out. He is, at the very least, holding out the possibility that he will find cause to terminate this relationship. Here's the prenuptial agreement. Oh, I love you. I never plan on divorcing you. But doesn't he, when he asks you here, sign this document, don't you know that he's holding out the possibility that he might find reason, he at least is legally thinking in terms of the possibility, that he might find reason to ask for a divorce, to nullify the marriage. And you'd say, he says he doesn't want to divorce me. He says he'll never divorce me. But once I put my signature on that piece of paper, I've given him at least a little bit more temptation to divorce me. Is it applicable? Is it a parallel situation to prenatal screening? Chris is calling from his car. Chris, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
I guess my thought on this is the screening is okay. It's the fact that abortion is legal is what makes it a difficult issue. If abortion wasn't legal, then the screening wouldn't have a possible negative effect. In other words, causing a parent to realize that they have a child that is a defect and having abortion is an option. So if abortion's not legal, then the screening really doesn't have as much of a moral dilemma to it.
Well, you're right there, Chris. And I agree, if abortion were not a possibility or a legal option, then of course this screening could be practiced. And what you're saying here is it's not the screening itself. And that's true. It's not the screening itself. But we don't live in that world. We live in the world where abortion is legal, and for the foreseeable future it will be legal, where abortion is procured on demand for any reason, for any excuse, where even the most trivial things, I mean, trivial things in life are used. Women don't want to have to change dress sizes or spend extra time at the gym to fit back into their old clothes is enough of an excuse for someone to have an abortion. And we live in a world where abortion is legal and is easily procured. And while I agree with you, it's not the screening itself, and would that we lived in a world where it wasn't legal, so that the screening could be something that the parents did purely out of concern for the well-being of their children in the womb. It's not the world we're living in. As I've pointed out many times here on Issues, Etc., Christians are not called to live in the world as we would have it be. We're called to live in the world as it is. This is the world we were called to live in, like it or not. See, I don't know what I'd do, honestly, if the doctor said, here's the option of doing the screening. I would find myself honestly torn. Well, you know, there's an argument to be made for doing it so that in the best interest of our child, without any option of abortion, doing it in the best interest of our child. Then Greg raises this question about, well, you know, do you want to add even 1% risk to your child's life in the womb? No. What parent would? Of course, the doctor might respond, you know, medicine is just the art of balancing risks. You have surgery, it does increase your risk for death, but you have surgery because you're trying to correct something. Every doctor, the minute he's going to do surgery on you, before he goes in there, he says, one of the possible outcomes of this whole procedure is you don't survive, because I can't guarantee you that nothing will go wrong. So life is full of risk. And so you balance risk, 1% risk, for the possibility of being able to better care for my child. That temptation thing, though, is pretty difficult to get past. We would pray that we were never tempted to do this. The fact of the matter is, as our listener pointed out in her email, there are untold numbers of babies for whom this screening is their death sentence. We're even talking now, and it's not talked about as much as it should be, selective abortion for the sex of the baby. You know, they don't even need to do really complicated tests for that one. The doctor has it in his folder the minute he tells you you're pregnant. You want to know if it's a boy or a girl? Someone says, I do want to know because I don't want any more girls. We're going to board all the girls and we're just going to have boys. I don't think it doesn't happen. You know, this is a great example of when the Christian lives in a fallen world. Even simple things like this, is this best for my child? Become extremely complicated. Where the Christian has to say, here's God's clear word, don't kill your children. Care for your children in every way you possibly can, to the greatest of your abilities. And live in Christian freedom. Maybe that's what's emerged from this conversation. Sometimes love does, sometimes love doesn't. No parent should fool themselves into saying, well, I'm impervious to temptation, so I'm going to do this. Nor should we bind consciences and say, look, every person who has this screening is going to end up wanting to abort their baby. Not everyone. Sometimes love does, and sometimes love doesn't. Now, a final thought on this whole issue of labels. And here's the real point of the whole, you know, we've got people out there who've got fivefold labels. I'm a conservative, Christian, Republican, pro-life American. There are five labels all stacked on top of one another. But when they go to church on Sunday morning, they don't want to be labeled. Oh, don't label me. Label me with according to my politics, because that's what really matters to me, by the way, is my politics. But don't label me with regard to my theology. It's the things that matter to us that we're willing to embrace as labels. Father, mother, American. Those are the ones that we really matter to us that we're willing to embrace. Maybe it's because our theology doesn't matter to us. But a word to that Christian, if you don't want to be labeled for your theology, then to be consistent, you shouldn't embrace political labels either. And to those who don't want the label liberal Christian, don't call me a liberal Christian. That doesn't further the conversation. That doesn't promote unity. Don't call me a liberal Christian. For those of you who don't want to be called liberal Christians, then to be consistent, number one, you shouldn't embrace the positive labels either. Like Christian is a positive label. Nor should you use a label on anyone else. If you don't want to be called a liberal Christian, then you should certainly not find yourself derisively referring to those who theologically disagree with you as conservatives or right-wingers. Because, by the way, those are labels too. You know what? Labels are good. They're good on food. If you went into the grocery store and every can was label-less, you wouldn't know what you were buying. Is it motor oil? Is it soup? Is it corn? Is it dried milk? Who knows what it is? It would be the stupidest way to run a business in the world. If you walked down the street and none of the street signs had any labels on them, you'd get lost. You'd never be able to tell where anyone lives. Where do you live? Well, I can't really tell you because my street has no name. Labels are good. They help us distinguish the right way from the wrong way, truth from error. And you know what? They're kind of a stand-up, brave thing to do. We embrace the labels because they speak the truth about who we are and what we believe.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What was the Protestant Reformation really all about? Who were its major figures? How did the culture and the politics of that day play into the Reformation movement? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for October is actually two books, volumes 1 and 2 of the Renaissance and Reformation movements by Dr. Lewis Spitz. These books are considered the gold standard in Reformation studies. Each volume is $23.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order the Renaissance and Reformation movements from Concordia Publishing House. Call them toll-free any weekday at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. book of the month for October, the Renaissance and Reformation movements. 1-800-325-3040.
Coke bottle, a lesson from the sky.
Answers with Ken Ham, host of the acclaimed and popular film, The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, you got me completely baffled on this one. What does a bottle of Coke have to do with creation and evolution?
Have you ever seen the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy? Someone drops a Coke bottle from a plane, and it drops near a group of bushmen in Africa. They've never seen anything like it. Now, the whole movie centers around a particular interpretation of what they thought the Coke bottle really was. Some believed it to be a gift from the gods. But after everyone started fighting over it, they decided it was an evil thing and sought to return it to the gods. You know, there is nothing inherently wrong with a Coke bottle, but it was the interpretation of it that led to problems. The same applies to the origins issue. Creationists and evolutionists all have the same facts, but interpret them differently based upon certain beliefs, just like the bushman in the movie. Either man's beliefs about the past or God's revealed word are used to interpret the facts. But I take comfort in knowing that real science over and over and over again confirms the interpretation based upon the Bible, not the one based upon man's fallible opinions.
Do the scriptures shed any light on the question, is there intelligent life or UFOs in outer space? Ken Ham looks at the Bible and science and then answers the question, is there life in outer space? And his answer can be found on our website, answersradio.com. Answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Many children today idolize sports figures, movie stars, and rock musicians, partly because the media glorifies the wealth and glamour of these stars. However, numerous surveys have shown that there are two heroes that are admired and respected by more children than any other. That's mom and dad. More children, including teens, respect and admire their parents more than any media personality in sports or entertainment. So don't abandon your role as a hero to the media superstars. Use your status as your children's hero to set a good example. Remind your children that their real hero, above all other heroes, is Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for them. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
You're invited to attend a special Reformation Day service Sunday, October 31st, 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Chapel of St. Timothy and St. Titus on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Those who cannot attend will be able to hear the service broadcast live here on AM 850 KFUO. Mark your calendar. The public is invited to attend. That's the Reformation Day service Sunday afternoon, October 31st, and live at 4 o'clock here on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. For the last 25 minutes, we are going to be talking with Dr. David Stevens, Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association, about Prop 71 in California. It would fund embryonic stem cell research, a clone and kill bill. We'll find out more about it in just a minute. We talk so much about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, here on the program. They underwrite the program very generously. And we talk about the sound theological training that young men get for the pastoral ministry at that seminary. Part of that sound theological training is training to understand and discern God's word as it speaks clearly to issues like we were talking about. Prenatal screening, these kind of things where the pastor says, man, you really are balancing the welfare of the child with this temptation to do something you never should do with your child, and that is to abort your unborn child. Well, where else to get better training in not only the theology, but also the ethics grounded in that sound theology as a pastor than Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana? You can find out more about not only the training there, but also about the seminary itself at www.ctsfw.edu. That's ctsfw.edu. Or you can call them toll free. You can even set up a visit to the campus if you're just thinking, maybe even mulling over the idea, remote possibility of becoming a pastor. Check it out. 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. David Stevens has been kind enough to join us, Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. We're going to talk first about prenatal screening, get his thoughts on that, and we'll talk about Prop 71 in California that would fund embryonic stem cell research. Dr. Stevens, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be with you.
First of all, your thoughts on prenatal screening. We just spent about 25 minutes talking about it during open lines and getting our listeners' thoughts on it. I'm interested in what you have to say.
Well, prenatal screening can be done ethically, and it also can be done unethically. It really depends on what you plan to do with the information that you've received. I think the way I guide patients in that area is, especially if there's something we can do to help the pregnancy, help the child with the difficulty that we've identified, or the mother, then the screening has benefit. But if the only option when you find out something is to abort or not abort the child, you're really wasting your money. You should have made that decision before the screening even started, that you're not going to abort your baby. Increasingly now, we're able to do things in utero, including some surgery, heart surgery, all sorts of things that we used not to be able to do 10 or 15 years ago. So the list of things we can screen for that we actually can help the baby in utero with is increasing. So I think the key question to ask your doctor is, what can I do with this information? If it is positive, what can we do during the pregnancy? Or if abortion is the only option, I'm not interested.
All right. Can you just very briefly outline some of the risks associated? In particular, we had a caller who talked about the increased risk for the baby itself with amniocentesis, part of these larger screening process.
Right. Amniocentesis has risk involved, and that's usually, this day and time, a second step because we're now able to actually get fetal cells from the mother's circulation and test those in the increasing number of tests. So the risk to the mother or the child is, the child's nil and the mother's just drawing blood. Amniocentesis is not something that should be taken lightly. The risk can be 1 to 3% of actually precipitating a premature delivery. And so, yes, I agree in that situation, unless there is something that is very suspicious that you can do something about, you shouldn't have an amniocentesis.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I appreciate you bringing your expertise to that question and a little bit of closure to our conversation from the last segment. We did get you on, however, to talk about Prop 71 in California. Most of our listeners are passingly familiar with this simply because the big news late last week was that the governor of California, Governor Schwarzenegger, decided to sign on to this bill, not sign the bill, but sign and put his support behind it. And, of course, there's been all sorts of rallies in favor of it. What is Prop 71?
Prop 71 is a voter initiative that will provide $3 billion of funding for embryonic stem cell research and human cloning research over the next 10 years. Now, to put that in perspective, that is as much money that was spent on the Human Genome Project by the federal government over 15 years. And it was very controversial when they were getting into that to spend that quantity of money. This will actually cost the California voters $6 billion, twice as much with interest. So to put that in perspective, they just borrowed $15 billion to keep the state out of bankruptcy. So this is a huge amount of money and a real largesse for bioethical companies, biotech companies, as well as scientists.
Well, your press release, the press release from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, says welfare for scientists.
Well, it is research without risk. Everyone in business loves that. And interestingly enough, the proposition doesn't even take any benefits as far as royalties, patents, or anything, and give them to the California government. They're going to kind of figure that out later. And the group that's actually supervising how the money's going to be spent is an independent citizens committee, which is not independent and it's not citizens, and it's really not going to provide oversight. It's the same people that are going to spend the money. So a number of people have spoken out on this, against this, not on moral grounds, but on the basis that this is fiscally irresponsible and people cannot really afford it.
What would Prop 71 actually fund?
What it will fund is research buildings, research equipment, sciences, scientist salaries, the research programs that are going on, testing, laboratories, really anything. It limits the funding, though, to funding that the government is not already providing funding for at the federal level. So that's code words to say they're going to do embryonic stem cells and human cloning. Even though the bill doesn't say the word cloning, it talks about somatic cell nuclear transfer to really obscure from the California people what they're authorizing. It actually creates a right to clone humans in the California Constitution.
I, I, I called it before a clone and kill bill. Now, I don't want to be confused there, because there are bills that purport to ban human cloning, which are actually clone and kill bills. But this is clone and kill, is it not, in the sense that what it would fund in terms of research would likely be the pursuit of human cloning toward the end, not of bringing about full-term babies, but of destroying those babies while they are embryos and harvesting their stem cells.
Well, interestingly enough, it requires the death of the clones, but it doesn't specify by when. So when this is passed, it literally will make it possible for people to clone and harvest fetuses. It essentially creates a group of subhuman beings that can be used in any way possible up to the point of delivery for research or therapy purposes.
Do you think that the lawmakers in California, do you think that the governor in California, do you think that the voters in California are aware of what we've just talked about here?
I don't think they are. And interestingly enough, the people promoting this who've put $20 million into it, but $20 million isn't much when you think you're going to get $3 billion out of it. It's the same people that will benefit, and they are just saturating the airwaves, both radio and television, trying to push this through, promising cures. Interestingly, when you look at embryonic stem cell research, scientists even involved in this area are admitting it's going to be 15 to 20 years before any type of therapy. And even then, they're not guaranteeing there's going to anything's going to happen to benefit patients. All this hype is to convince people that, you know, their miracle cure is just around the corner. Bottom line, that's not true. What we found out about embryonic stem cells in the last 6 years is that they're difficult to culture. They're difficult to work with because they mutate. They tend to cause tumors when you transplant them into animals. 20% of the time, they become a teratoma, which is a very dangerous type of tumor. They require human cloning to use them, and the list just goes on and on. They're very difficult to control their differentiation. How do you get them to become one of the 210 different types of cells in the human body? So this is unrealistic as far as what it's hoping to do. And secondly, it's unnecessary. The diseases that we want to treat with stem cells, we're already seeing enormous success with adult stem cells, and we should be putting our money where we're going to get results quickly and ethically.
There was a very well-stated question during, I think it was the second presidential debate, when the audience members were allowed to ask questions. One of the questions stated, I think, by a woman said, look, with all the successes, virtually all the successes in stem cell research coming from adult stem cells that do not require the destruction of anyone in order to harvest the stem cells, she asked both candidates, why all the emphasis, why not talk about the federal funding for adult stem cell research rather than embryonic stem cell research? Now, Senator John Kerry, his answer simply kind of touted the possibilities of embryonic stem cell research. What did you make of his response?
Well, you know, the science doesn't support that concept, and that is this. We talk about Parkinson's disease, diabetes, people like Christopher Reeves with spinal cord injury. Let me tell you what's happening in adult stem cell research. In California at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, 4 years ago, they harvested adult stem cells from the brain of a patient with Parkinson's disease, grew them in the laboratory, and gave them back to the patient, and he got an 81% improvement in his symptoms. He was a wildlife photographer that was shaking so bad he couldn't even hold a camera, and since then he's been on safaris all over the world. In Spain, a physician there is using stem cells from the olfactory bulb, which is up in the back of the nose. You can get it by going up with some instruments, harvesting those cells, transplanting them into the spinal cord of patients that are paraplegic and quadriplegic. 20 patients so far, some of them are getting their bladder function back, they're getting increased sensation, they're walking with walkers. Miraculous stuff. Just last month, a report out of Germany of a man who had his whole jaw removed due to cancer 9 years ago. They made a titanium mesh in the shape of a jaw, put in some purified cow bone as well as his own stem cells from his bone marrow, implanted it in his back. 7 weeks later, took it out. He had grown a new jaw. They implanted it in his face, and he ate his first hamburger in 9 years. Now, this isn't promises. This is real success. We've already cured diabetes in mice using pancreatic duct stem cells in the laboratory. The real successes are happening with adult stem cells. So why are people so anxious to use embryonic? I think scientists, for one reason, is that's where the money's to be made. Because how do you patent adult stem cells when you take them out of the patient and give them back to them? The whole furor over the federally funded stem cell lines is not about their limitations, but by the fact that somebody already owns them and has patented them, and if you make a discovery on them, then you have to pay royalties. So the bottom line, this boils down to money.
So that's really the dirty little secret of embryonic stem cell research, is that this is about higher profits for the research, for the companies that are they're going to fund and do the research.
Well, everybody creating a stem cell line is patenting it, and there's all sorts of processes you have to do to actually do therapy. You have to clone the patient. You have to create an embryo, sacrifice the embryo, get the cells to differentiate. You can patent all those processes and make a huge amount of money. And that's why scientists are interested in it. The other reason is this is the first time in modern science that a scientist will have the opportunity to do destructive research on human beings without any oversight. And you can always learn more with destructive research than you can when you have to protect the patient. Just ask the Nazis. They learned a lot during World War II experimenting on concentration camp victims and got information that no other scientist could get.
You have said that Prop 71 in California puts the financial fox in charge of the hen house. What do you mean by that?
The same people that are going to get the money are the ones that are supervising it, and that's dangerous. In fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and they were very concerned about this because, and they thought it was morally okay to do the research, but they said this is probably the most irresponsible proposition that's been on the ballot in California's history. Because of the fact that the people that get the money are the ones that are actually supposed to be guarding it. And the opportunity for misuse is just tremendous.
Dr. David Stevens is our guest, executive director of the Christian Medical Association. We're talking about Prop 71 in California that would fund embryonic stem cell research with taxpayer dollars to the tune of $3 billion, and that's not counting interest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Again, Senator Kerry and others have talked about doing this research, and they have the caveat, we do it with the strictest of ethical guidelines. Are there any ethical guidelines that under which embryonic stem cell research of the kind proposed by Prop 71 in California could be done that would make it an ethical thing?
It's not. It's always morally wrong to take a human being's life, and this is the powerful cannibalizing the powerless. And what's happening in medicine, unfortunately, and especially in biotech industry, is they bring in ethicists to try to justify what they're already planning to do, to put a nice veneer around it so that people will not be upset about it. You know, what's been interesting to watch in this debate is the verbal engineering which preceded the social engineering. Good example of this just happened last month. The International Society of Stem Cell Researchers came out with a news release saying there was a new nomenclature, and now no one in scientific publications or in the popular press should use the word cloning. They should always use the word nuclear transfer or somatic cell nuclear transfer. What they were doing was taking a word that people are opposed to, substituting it with the word that they don't know anything about, and clouding what they're doing. We did the same thing in the abortion debate. It went from abortion to evacuating the products of conception, a term that's scientifically accurate but meaningless to most people.
If there were a breakthrough, let's say for the sake of argument, there were a breakthrough in the technology that made embryonic stem cell research not the dangerous thing that you talked about before with the high risk of developing essentially tumors and cancers, but they found a way to do this that would avoid that. And they said, look, now we have found a way to correct the pancreatic problems that diabetes sufferers have. We found a way to deal with Parkinson's, and it's through the use of embryonic stem cell research. And let's say for the sake of argument that it even was more potentially curative than even adult stem cell research, and people could be cured. Would that make it right?
No, it would not be right, and that's the main issue. Not only is this unnecessary and also not impractical, but it's immoral. And I think each one of us need to understand that we were each an embryo. And that was us at that point in time. We were perfectly developed, had all the genetic information and all the cellular machinery to continue our development throughout life. And if somebody had destroyed us at that point for our stem cells, we wouldn't be here today. That was who we are. And if we have value now, we have value in utero or in the laboratory as an embryo. When you destroy a human being, you take the future, you take the life of a person. And I think one of the ironic things, you know, we read in the Old Testament about human sacrifice, and people were trying to appease the gods for health and long life. Here we're going back to the same era where we're actually sacrificing human beings on the altar of science to get health and to get long life. And that's ironic and tragic.
505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Barry calls from his car. Barry, welcome to Issues, Etc. Hi, Barry. Barry, welcome.
A report I had heard on the radio on another station is a news report, and there was a doctor on there, and he claimed that the adult stem cells can't be used for, I can't remember all the things. He named several things. I think one of them were brain dysfunctions and some things like that. And, you know, it's something I had never heard before, and I kind of wanted to get your bent on that.
Sure, Barry. And what he's doing is quoting information from 6 years ago. He's out of date. We used to think that adult stem cells are what we call multipotent. A bone marrow stem cell could become a red blood cell, white blood cell, but it couldn't become brain. It couldn't become heart. What we found in the last 6 years is that stem cells are found throughout many tissues in the body, including fat, which I'm particularly excited about because we have an unlimited supply of it in this country, and that those cells tend to take on the characteristic of the damaged organ you place them in. Just last week out of Argentina came a report where they were taking bone marrow stem cells and infusing them into the coronary arteries of patients that had heart attacks. The cells went into the heart. Some of them differentiated into the type of cells to make new blood vessels, and others became heart muscle. And so what he's quoting is very old information, and we now know that there are stem cells in the brain, in cartilage, in fat, in skin, in liver, and the list just goes on and on, even in the retina.
Now, I want you to respond to a few common rhetorical so-called tours de force that are used in this debate. And we've heard a lot of them lately as it's been come to the fore in the presidential debate. Look, to stand in the way of embryonic stem cell research and to refuse to fund it with taxpayer money is to stand in the way of science. How do you respond?
Well, science can be used for good or evil, just like most things in this world. And we are crossing the continental divide of ethics in medicine when we adopt a utilitarian ethic and say we can take a human being's life for the good of many people. Where do you draw the line after you say that? Now they're saying at 14 days of development, but California now, they're going further and saying clear up until the point of delivery. That's what New Jersey has said as well. Why not do that with newborn infants? Why not with one-year-olds, two-year-olds? We are essentially defining groups of people out of the human race. Why not with condemned prisoners? Why not with patients in coma before they're actually dead and we could find out some good information? We've always said in our ethical codes that no research should be done where there's prior reason to believe that serious injury or death will result. We're crossing that line, and it's a very dangerous thing to do. It's now in all our codes, in the Nuremberg Code, the MA's Code, and all of a sudden we're crossing that line, and that puts every person in danger.
The researchers who do this are obviously brilliant individuals in terms of their intellect and their learning. Is it possible that they don't know that what they're dealing with in the womb, even if it's the product of cloning off in the future, is in fact a full-blown human being at the stage of an embryo?
Well, if they don't, they shouldn't be a doctor. All the standard embryology texts say that, when the sperm unites with the egg, a new human being is formed. The way they get around that and the way the American Medical Association gets around it is they say, yes, it's a human being, but it's not a person. And what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years is the definition of personhood has been separated from being a human being.
But isn't that a metaphysical category which science, by its own admission, cannot measure personhood as opposed to being? I mean, if it's a human life, you can measure that, but in terms of chromosomes, things like that. But personhood is a metaphysical category.
Well, what they've done is used to be defined on the basis of every being of human origin as a person. Now they say personhood is based upon certain capabilities and characteristics, consciousness, the ability to feel pain. You'll hear people saying, well, you know, you destroy an embryo, it doesn't feel anything. Well, that's all smoke that they're blowing to justify what they're doing. Let me give you an example. If you started having abdominal pain right now and I diagnosed appendicitis and took you in the operating room and very kindly took care of you and assured you I was going to take care of you as I put you to sleep, but then killed you after you were asleep, you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't feel any pain. You wouldn't even have been afraid. But have I harmed you? Obviously, I've harmed you. You didn't feel anything, but I've taken away your future. The same's true of an embryo. Just because an embryo doesn't feel anything doesn't mean it can't be harmed. But they use all these type of ways of defining personhood that put a lot of people in danger, especially at the end of life when you may not be conscious or be able to reason or all the other things they say you have to be able to do to be a person, and then justify physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, and other things the same way.
Give us, if you would, in the last few minutes here, Dr. Stevens, a bit of a cold slap in the face with regard to science. While many scientists, researchers, medical professionals do act from a genuine thirst for knowledge or altruism or the desire to alleviate suffering, is it true of every scientist? Can we live with the illusion that science is simply seeking our benefit?
Well, unfortunately, people in this country have turned science into God, and that's where facts are, and values are just something that you believe internally, and that's fine for you, but it's not what I believe, and they don't see ultimate truth. Scientists are self-serving, like everyone else, and what's happened increasingly in research science in the major universities in this country is it's difficult to pay them adequate salaries to attract them from the business world. So what the university says is, you come work for us. If we find something patentable, we'll share that patent with you. Go out and start a for-profit company, and we'll both share the profits. So they have a profit motive. Irvin Weissman, who's been one of the main proponents of embryonic stem cells at Stanford, just sold his last stem cell company for $200 million. And he's going to be one getting money for his research in California through Proposition 71. So to think that these scientists don't have selfish motives for power, prestige, and money is just really being blind.
The website for the Christian Medical Association is cmdahome.org, cmdahome.org, or their toll-free number, 1-888-231-2637. Dr. Stevens, thank you very much for being our guest.
Glad to be with you, and there's lots of free resources on stem cells on that website. I encourage people to go there.
Dr. David Stevens, Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. Tomorrow on the program, what about Halloween? Well, it's coming up Sunday, isn't it? Kind of crept up on you, didn't it? What about Halloween? Should Christians engage in Halloween activities? Gretchen Pasentino will be our guest. We'll also talk about Martin Luther with Dr. Paul Meyer. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.